Welcome to It's All Politics from NPR News. I'm Ron Elving.
And Ron, and I'm Ken Rudin.
And Ron, you're Ken Rudin.
I would like to wish you a happy 100th podcast.
I was going to say, for the 100th time, I'm Ron Elving and you're Ken Rudin. And so, for our Gala 100th podcast, Ken, I think we really ought to pause and just relive for a moment some of the great highlights of the first 100 podcasts.
Let's, for now, for the next few seconds, we're going to play the funniest moments. Ready?
Okay. Are you ready? Hey, that was really something, wasn't it?
You're pretty funny guys.
Those were very funny moments.
Yeah. Well, anyway, a lot to talk about this week.
A lot to talk about this week in our 100th podcast, Ken. Oregon and Kentucky and a threshold crossed for the Obama campaign and perhaps a threshold crossed for the Clinton campaign. What might I be talking about, Ken?
As usual, I have no idea. For the Barack Obama campaign, the fact that they have gone over the majority of the pledged delegates that were at stake in all the primaries and caucuses.
1,627.
That's right.
And that gave them an absolute majority of the pledged delegates, not counting Michigan and Florida, to be mentioned later.
Now, of course, he was not declaring victory. He was not rubbing.
Oh, no.
He wasn't
declaring victory, Ken. That's why he went all the way back to
Iowa, which is voting very soon. It's voting
on the 3rd. No, he went back to Iowa to rub it in. He went back to Iowa to say, this is where
tour.
It began, and now it's over. And whatever happened in Kentucky and Pennsylvania and West Virginia and Ohio, it doesn't matter because I've got the numbers. And here's a truism I think is going on here. Barack Obama can afford at this moment to play the magnanimous, cordial, larger-than-life figure. He can reach out and say very nice things and sounded like fairly genuine, earnest things about what a great campaign Hillary Clinton has won because he's convinced that he's beaten her, so he can be generous, knowing, of course, all along that the symbolism of his doubling back to Des Moines, Iowa, where he first beat Hillary Clinton on January 3rd, will not be lost on anyone, that the media will pick up on the crossing of this threshold to essentially anoint him, and that some of his supporters, some of the people who are his surrogates, and also a lot of people in our business, Ken, will ratify exactly that view of what happened.
And you see that in the Obama campaign as well. We'll talk about David Axelrod in a few minutes about the compromise he's willing to make regarding Michigan and Florida. But I thought it was interesting that as Barack Obama is doing this victory tour, he's getting wiped out in another state. In Kentucky, Hillary Clinton won by 250,000 votes.
A huge margin in a small state.
In a small state.
65% of the vote. And he didn't even get the other 35. He only got 30%
right.
of the vote.
Which follows a blowout defeat for Obama in West Virginia the
41
previous week.
Points.
Right. And then, of course, you know, the 9-10 point loss in Pennsylvania. So as he is the presumptive, I think we could say that, the presumptive Democratic nominee.
No way around it. He's got the numbers. He's got the delegates.
He is still... I think Hillary Clinton is peaking at a too late point, but still at a very interesting point, perhaps showing weaknesses that the Democratic nominee will have going into the fall.
We now know that, assuming that he is the nominee, she will be the person who got the most votes, the most delegates, and the most states of any person who did not get the nomination.
And the most votes of any female presidential candidate since...
Shirley Chisholm.
In 1972.
And the highest percentage of any woman running for president since?
Margaret Chase Smith.
In 1964.
The Republicans. The lady from Maine.
That's right. Now, we have studied all of this partly because...
We're lonely.
A very large proportion of the supporters of Hillary Clinton have become convinced that the role of the media in the success of Barack Obama and perhaps the role of the media in the way we have treated Hillary Clinton is a factor in her defeat, maybe not the controlling factor, let's not over-aggrandize the role here, but that it is an annoying factor, an irritant, to the degree that they're just not going to vote for Barack Obama.
Well, we saw that in exit polls. I don't know if it's just a sexism charge, a misogynist charge, the argument that the media has picked a favorite. I think to some extent the media has picked a favorite.
Wouldn't it make more sense then to punish the media? I mean, don't watch Tim Russert.
Exactly.
Don't watch Keith Olbermann. Don't watch Ken Rudin.
If you're a Democrat who wants to end the 8 years of George Bush by extension, John McCain, why would you take out your frustration on Barack Obama?
Particularly given the effort that he's already made. And let's get back to David Axelrod, chief strategist for the Barack Obama campaign, saying on NPR this week that they're willing to go more than halfway to accommodate Michigan and Florida, even giving her more delegates than she would otherwise be entitled to under the rules.
First of all, Hillary Clinton has said from the beginning that one of the reasons she's staying in the race is that all votes matter and all votes should be counted. And, of course, Michigan...
Every voice should be heard.
And Michigan and Florida should be heard. And, of course, the DNC will have its meeting on May 31st, which will presumably try to resolve this dilemma. But Axelrod said to on an NPR that if Barack Obama is the nominee, if the numbers in Michigan are not going to alter that calculation, why not be magnanimous? Why not send an olive branch over to the Clinton campaign saying, look, whatever mistakes that the officials in Florida and Michigan made, whatever mistakes that the DNC made, we shouldn't penalize the voters of Florida and Michigan. And Hillary Clinton, we neither of us campaigned in that state. You did win a majority of the state. Why not have the most delegates? I mean, I think both sides would agree to that.
That's right. And there are three reasons, really, for this. Number one, Florida itself. You want to keep Florida in play as long as you can in November, even if it's eventually going to go Republican. Number two, Michigan, which is a got-to-have state for the Democrats. They really can't put together 270 electoral votes without Michigan. And then number three, it's the balm. It's the outreach to all these Hillary Clinton supporters who feel that they've been given a bad deal and that somehow Michigan and Florida have come to symbolize that bad deal.
We saw in the exit polls out of Kentucky, and we've seen this in previous exit poll states, that, but even more dramatic, I thought, in Kentucky, that only one-third of Hillary Clinton supporters say they're likely to support Barack Obama in the fall. And, of course, this is in the heat of a very tough and personal nomination
and
battle.
The point is well taken that people have said this about people they didn't vote for in the primaries.
John McCain.
In the past.
John McCain in 2000.
Even Bill Bradley and Al Gore in 2000. And certainly Jimmy Carter and Teddy Kennedy in 1980. But what, of course, would set apart 1980 is a lot of them didn't
vote
for Jimmy
exactly
Carter.
Right. And you also have the prospect of what about gender and race and what role that may play in people not coming out to vote in the fall.
What's the price of getting the peace within the Democratic
Party?
Well,
it'll be interesting to see who Barack Obama names to his ticket, and I assume that'll be well in advance of the Denver convention. It could be a woman, and
there are many women who might heal a little bit the wounds here.
Kathleen Sebelius and
Janet Napolitano of Arizona.
Amy Klobuchar and Amy Kelohanu.
Yes. I think there are probably a lot
Claire
of people.
Claire McCaskill.
Christine Gregoire, the governor of Washington State.
Right.
None of these people, though, address some of the other needs of the Obama ticket. In other words, they don't come from a big swing state, and they don't bring what you would call national security.
And they're all Obama supporters, so it would be interesting. Maybe you go to a Hillary supporter, like a Ted Strickland, the governor of Ohio. Ed Rendell has counted himself out. Jim Webb of Virginia, I think that's the reason he wrote his book, so he's considered for the ticket.
And I think he would be, in many ways, an excellent choice in that he's not politics as usual. He comes from a red state.
Right.
He served in the Reagan cabinet. He has a certain amount of independence.
He was star of Dragnet.
And his national security credibility could not be greater. He is a decorated war hero. He was Secretary of the Navy.
His top aides bring guns into the Capitol.
Well, right there, that shows a certain kind of macho, don't you think?
I
a certain
have one
cred.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So,
what was that?
Let us also think, though, what does Jim Webb get you in terms of bringing home those Hillary Clinton voters who feel disrespected and feel that the women's movement was left behind by the Barack Obama movement?
Well, I don't think Jim Webb does that.
No, I don't think he does.
No.
So that's a big problem. And if Hillary Clinton really wants this, all she really needs to do is let it be known that that's the price of peace as far as she's concerned.
With VP?
That's right.
No.
And if that is known, and if her delegates, and let's face it, she's going to have a couple thousand delegates at this convention,
right,
especially when we get Michigan and Florida added back in, and the overall total goes up around what? What is it going to be, 4,400, 4,500? She's going to have a couple thousand people there on the floor who not only support her, but want to get some form of recognition and respect before they leave Denver.
Okay, now a few podcasts ago, another great moment that I'm sure that Ron Elving doesn't want us to repeat, but you predicted Kay Bailey Hutchison would be the Republican nominee for vice president.
I said she was someone who should be very seriously considered.
Yeah, that's the stupidest thing I've ever heard in my life. But do you really think that Hillary Clinton, what percent do you give Hillary Clinton on an Obama ticket?
If he were free to choose, zero.
Yeah.
Because, not because he doesn't respect her, but because what she brings to the ticket is too much of the past, especially Bill.
Right.
The baggage of Bill is number one.
Right.
Number two, she represents the past and not the new politics.
Right, and that change.
And he would rather choose somebody who was part of his transformative effort. That's what his campaign is all about.
Right.
But he may not really get to choose. Did Jack Kennedy really want LBJ to be his vice president in 1960? No, but he needed him to get Texas to win.
So what happened?
So he gave it to LBJ, he got Texas, and he won.
Yes, but let me just interrupt for 1 second, because even though Kennedy and Johnson did not like each other, they did not run in the primaries against each other.
They did.
No, they didn't. Johnson didn't run in any primaries.
Well, but Johnson was very interested in being president, and everybody knew he was running for president in 1960.
But he didn't go around.
It was a different system. The primaries didn't choose the nominee. In the sense that the system worked in 1960, they did run against each other. And it was a real rivalry, and there was a great lack of respect between them.
Yes, but they didn't call each other the kind of names we heard in 2008 between Obama and Clinton.
Well, maybe not in public, but I think that was a highly rivalrous and rancorous relationship.
Rivalrous?
Yes, and rancorous. Mm-hmm. But for the moment, the real question is, does Obama even have a choice? If it's presented to him as a kind of fait accompli, as the ticket he must punch in order to get the nomination and be viable in the fall, won't he pay the price?
No, because I don't think that's the argument. I don't even think she'll make that argument. I think there may be some demands she'll make. She may want her things in the platform, certainly on universal health coverage, perhaps even, you know, paring down her debt or some way. But I doubt very much that one of her demands will be on the ticket.
We've already spent some time traveling back in time to 1960, talking a little bit about the Kennedy-Johnson ticket. Another year that's coming to mind very often in recent days is 1980, when you had a tremendously divisive struggle between Jimmy Carter, the incumbent Democratic president, and his challenger, Teddy Kennedy, the senator from Massachusetts, long time assumed to be interested in the presidency after both his brothers were martyred, and then became a candidate finally in 1980, was not terribly successful, but went all the way to the convention, contesting it, wanting his moment in the sun, giving this great speech, fighting against the Jimmy Carter whose campaign was led by his chief of staff, Hamilton Jordan. And this week,
in that paragraph, you mentioned two people, Ted Kennedy, who suffered a malignant brain tumor this week. We don't know, as of this podcast, we don't know what the prognosis is. We don't know how far the tumor has spread. We don't know what treatments the senator is going to call for. Look, Arlen Specter suffered a malignant brain tumor years ago. So let's not write him off just yet. I did see a lot of the cable news talking about Ted Kennedy in the past tense.
Shameful.
It was regrettable.
It's shameful. Yeah. I mean, even though this is obviously a dire diagnosis and he is going to have to fight, it is way premature to talk about him in the past tense. But we do know that Hamilton Jordan, who has been fighting cancer for 22 years, let us hasten to add, succumbed this week.
I think with 24/7 cable coverage, there's no such thing as a Jimmy who could come from out of nowhere and do well in the Iowa caucuses, win the New Hampshire primary, go on to the nomination.
As Carter did then.
And Hamilton Jordan picked this unknown former governor who they had this plan from the beginning, and they saw things that nobody else saw, and shows how the pundits were wrong not only in 2008 but 1976, and they did it. But one more thing about Ted Kennedy I want to say, though, just going back over his career, he was always thrust into that position. I mean, when he ran for the Senate in 1962, he was barely old enough. He looked like he was really like a dilettante who really probably shouldn't have been in the Senate, but he was Jack, the President Kennedy's brother. When after Bobby was shot in 68, they wanted him to run for vice president, for president. They wanted him to run in 72.
He was, 37 years old. They were trying to run him for president.
They wanted him to be McGovern's running mate. They wanted him in 76. It was interesting that even in 1980, when the only time he ran for president, he took on a fellow Democrat. He still wasn't ready for it. But he did something in the Senate that, for obvious reasons, neither Jack nor Bobby accomplished. He grew as a legislator, and I think
that he was committed to being a legislator.
Yeah, and he's, you know, and I think both sides will say that he's certainly one of the giants in the history of the Senate, and it's almost by accident because the fact that everybody told him he should be president, and when that didn't work, he said, well, you know something, I'm going to do something that I can be very good at, and he is a very good and an effective senator.
One of the most effective movers of legislation ever in the United States Senate. 45 years he has already served. He is still serving. And he stands number 3 in the all-time seniority list now.
After, of course,
Robert C. Byrd, still serving, still president pro tempore in the Senate, and Strom Thurmond, who retired from the Senate at the age of 100.
And let's hope that we'll be talking about current Senator Kennedy in our 200th podcast.
I'm for that. That's it for this week's political podcast.
You can follow NPR's political coverage at npr.org/elections.
I'm Ron Elving.
And I'm Ken Rudin.
Join us again next week for It's All Politics from NPR. Oh, baby, how you like